We are doing Tanya 200, and we're up to chapter 32. In chapter 31, as an introduction to chapter 32, the Rebbe explains how the person who can be humble and critical of himself, truly humble, by taking into account all the unholiness that separates us from the truth and the godliness of our Father in heaven, which is the cure to smugness. A person needs to have this awareness, this humble awareness of our own distance, of our own unholiness, in order to remain alive and responsive to holy thoughts and to holy issues, to not be complacent. At the same time, we don't want to be sad, and we don't want to be lifeless because of our unholy or unhappy condition. So the Rebbe says that after the person considers his own humility, his ugliness, he then has to console himself in two ways. It's called a double consolation. He has to console himself in order to bring back the joy. And this would be the case where true sadness is useful and justified because it intensifies, it increases the joy that follows. Joy that comes after a sadness is a greater joy than one that was not preceded by sadness. But this would have to be a true sadness, meaning not a lifelessness. A true sadness means the feeling that I cannot permit, I can't allow life to continue as it is. It's unacceptable, it's intolerable. And that feeling is a true sadness in that it is alive. It doesn't let you sleep. Something's got to change. Now that kind of sadness brings to an increase of joy. And the increase of joy comes from the following consideration. A person should say to his heart, it is all true. Despicable, disgusting, sinful, wicked, evil, it's all true. But that's only part of me. That's the human part. That's the animal part. It's not the godly part. And within me, there is a godly soul that is in exile within me. Because if it wasn't in exile within me, it would have a greater influence on me, and I wouldn't be so unholy. But the unholy self, the unholy me, contains a godly soul, a pure soul. And the more unholy I am, the more painful is the exile or the imprisonment of this soul within me, which means the more unholy I am, the coarser I am, the less opportunity or the less ability the godly soul has to express itself. It can't function in such a coarse environment. And so it's in exile, it's imprisoned within me. And the more corrupt I am, the greater is the pity on the godly soul. So instead of feeling bad about how unholy my animal soul is, I should be more concerned with the godly soul and its pain of imprisonment. And therefore, I put all my efforts, I turn all my attention to doing those things that will permit the godly soul to express itself, that will permit the godly soul to feel more at home. As the Rebbe says, to allow her to return to her father's home as in her youth. Which means, before the godly soul comes down into the body, it is very close with God, it is a piece of God from above, and when it comes down into the body, it gets separated. Not only in terms of distance, spatial distance, but it gets separated in that it gets blocked. Communication between the godly soul and her father in heaven is blocked by the unholiness of the animal soul. To return the godly soul to her father's home, as in her youth, doesn't mean to die and have the soul go back to heaven. It means to create an environment here on earth in which the godly soul can feel at home and close to God, to her Father in heaven. How do we do that? By thinking, speaking, and doing that which is godly. So by thinking Torah, by speaking words of Torah, and by doing the mitzvahs of the Torah, the soul feels like it's back in heaven, back in her Father's home. So that's the first consolation. Although my animal soul is unholy, and all of the critical things I said about it are true, but there's another reality, there's another dimension that deserves compassion, and that when I turn my attention to giving the godly soul what the godly soul needs, the freedom that the godly soul will experience and the ability to express herself through the prayer and through the mitzvahs brings such a joy to the godly soul that I get caught up in that joy and can't be distracted by the animal soul's unholy condition. And that's because the godly soul is so much more precious than the animal soul that we don't let the animal soul's unhappy circumstances dampen the joy and the enthusiasm of the godly soul experiencing her freedom. Because there's no greater joy, that Eber says, than coming out of imprisonment, coming out of the dungeon, and being able to return to your father's home, particularly when your father is a king, and even more so when your father is the king of kings. So when the soul can go back to feeling in touch with God, that joy is the greatest of joys, and we don't let the animal soul reign on our godly soul's parade. So that's the first consolation. That's where the joy replaces the pain of the splintering and of the humbling considerations. So now we have a human being who has a wonderful combination. Inside, deep down inside, his heart is splintered to 1,000 pieces because he knows how unholy he is. But on the functioning level, there is a great joy because the freedom that the godly soul feels when we do the mitzvah and when we study the Torah, that completely removes any trace of sadness that the animal soul might produce. So we have a person who is deeply humbled by the realization of his own unholiness, and yet he is profoundly joyful in his service of God. And that's coming out of Egypt. When the people came out of Egypt, their animal soul was not pure. They were very much affected by the unholiness of Egypt, Egyptian beliefs, Egyptian culture, and so on. But the godly soul needed a break, and it needed to go to Mount Sinai, and it needed to talk to God at Mount Sinai and hear the commandments and so on. And so we left Egypt to do our godly soul a favor while our animal soul was still quite humbling in its unholiness. So that's any time that we feel that we need to just get away from the unholy. We can't fix it. We can't remove it. We just got to get away from it and turn our attention to the godly and to the holy and give our godly soul some freedom. That's coming out of Egypt. And that's why every generation, every individual needs to come out of Egypt. This is serving God even when our animal soul is not ready. To the second consolation. The second consolation goes something like this. It is all true. The unholiness, the despicable, evil, wicked, sinfulness of the animal soul, it's all true, without a doubt. But I didn't create myself this way. We didn't choose to have freedom of choice, to have a dark side, a negative side. God created us this way. And why would he do something like this? Why would God send a piece of himself from the highest of heavens down to the most unholy of conditions and have a godly soul subjected to the unholiness of the animal soul? Why? Why such a descent? The only explanation is that this descent is meant to bring a greater ascent, some kind of growth or some kind of elevation that wouldn't be possible otherwise. And what is that elevation? To elevate the animal soul. The animal soul does not forever remain unholy. It is the job and the mission and the purpose of the godly soul to elevate the animal soul to godliness. And that's called making for God a dwelling place in the lowest world. And so if that's what I'm doing, then obviously I have no reason to be sad. This is not my plan, it's God's plan. He needs a dwelling place in the lowest world, and the lowest world has to include an animal soul. That's what makes it low. And that's where God wants to be. God wants to have total comfort, to be himself completely in the world of the animal soul. And we're given the opportunity, the privilege of bringing that about. And so having an animal soul and being subjected to the whims of the animal soul is not a cruel punishment or some kind of a test. It's the job. This is where we do for God what God ultimately wants, and that is a dwelling place in the lowest world. So the joy that we do the mitzvah with, or we study the Torah with, is doubled and quadrupled by these consolations. Every time I do a mitzvah, which has to be done with the physical body, it involves the animal soul. Because the animal soul is the animator of the body's activity and behavior, so that if I give a dollar to charity, it's the animal soul doing it. Of course, the godly soul influenced the animal soul to do it. So the animal soul is becoming more godly with every mitzvah that I fulfill. Every time I say a blessing, every time I read a word of Torah, I'm engaging the animal soul in something godly, and the animal world, the lowest world, is becoming more hospitable to God's presence, and eventually will become God's home, his main home, more godly than heaven. That's chapter 31, which leads us directly into chapter 32. The joy that is increased after the sadness is really the objective here. The Rebbe is talking about the virtue, the greatness, the indispensable need for joy in the service of God. The greatness of joy has many, many aspects, many benefits. One of them is that through joy we become more loving of our fellow Jew. Now, obviously, a person who is in a good mood, who is joyful, is more loving in general. He's more hateful too. Because a person who is happy, a person who is open to emotion, will feel all the emotions more intensely than a person who is sad. So the happy person hates more intensely than the sad person, because a sad person has no energy to love or hate. The person who is joyful has a lot of emotional energy available to him, and therefore he will love more intensely. He'll also hate more intensely, if he's going to hate at all. So in general, when you're happy, you are more emotional, you have more feeling. But more specifically, we have a commandment in the Torah, which is one of the fundamental commandments of Torah, and that is to love our fellow Jew as ourselves. Very demanding, a very idealistic mitzvah. To love every Jew as yourself. Well, there are two things about this mitzvah. First of all, loving every Jew, that seems wildly ambitious. And as much as yourself, that too seems to be so idealistic as to be unreal. Do we ever love anyone as much as we love ourselves? And here we're told to love everyone as much as we love ourselves. How is this possible? This is one of the virtues of joy, the way that Eber described it in the previous chapter, because the joy enables us to fulfill this commandment that otherwise is impossible. And it goes something like this. To be joyful, in spite of all the true, unholy and distasteful characteristics of our animal soul, in order to still be holy, to still be happy, and even happier than before, we have to make our godly soul more precious to us than our animal soul. If our animal soul is more precious to us, then the fact that the animal soul is so wicked and so unholy will depress us. If our godly soul is more important and more precious, then even if the animal soul is depressing, we can't be distracted by that, and we join the godly soul in its joy when it can do a mitzvah, when it can fulfill a commandment, when it can say holy words or think holy thoughts. That's the only way to have joy and humility at the same time, and you have to have both. When we attain this, when we've come to an understanding and to an appreciation of the godly soul, to where we can be happy with the godly soul's joy that silences the unhappiness or the painfulness of the animal soul's darkness or unholiness, then this joy also has the advantage and the virtue of allowing us to love our fellow Jew as ourselves. Because the only way to love a fellow Jew properly is by loving the Jewish soul in him, the godly soul. Who appreciates the godly soul in another person? Only someone to whom his own godly soul is more precious than his natural soul, than his animal soul. So if the animal soul is important to us, then we look at other people and we see their animal soul. Two things are going to happen. First of all, you're not going to love every Jew, because not every Jew's animal soul is lovable. And secondly, even if you find a Jew whose animal soul, meaning his human personality traits, are all lovable, you don't love him like yourself. You're still more precious to yourself than even a lovable other being. But when the godly soul is more precious to you than your animal soul, which means that the fact that you're a Jew is more thrilling to you than your own personality, than your individual personality, if the Jewishness in you is your joy in life, then when you look at a fellow Jew, what are you seeing? More of yourself. Because all Jewish souls, all the godly souls, are the same. We all come from the same Father, and in our origins, we really are just one big soul that gets divided into smaller pieces. So what does it mean to love your fellow Jew as yourself? It doesn't mean as much as yourself, because you might not love yourself enough. And then you're not going to love anybody else enough either. So it's not a matter of quantity. It's not love your fellow Jew as much as yourself. It's love your fellow Jew as yourself, because the other Jew's soul is the same soul as yours. What makes him Jewish is what makes you Jewish. And therefore, if you love the Jew in you, then you love all other Jews as yourself, because that's what it is. It is yourself. Now, loving the stranger, loving the orphan, the widow, loving those people who deserve to be loved, either out of compassion or out of respect, that's not as yourself. That is loving others. So we love other human beings because they're human beings, because of the dignity of their human soul. But when it comes to a fellow Jew, if you don't love your fellow Jew for being Jewish, maybe you don't love yourself for being Jewish. So here's the connection. The person who can be humble and at the same time be happy because his godly soul, the Jew in him, is his joy in life, that has the advantage and the virtue of leading easily and directly into fulfilling a mitzvah that otherwise seems to be impossible. Love every Jew as you love yourself. Now, to make this even deeper, to show how great and powerful this joy is, the Rebbe then goes on to say in chapter 32 that there are certain people who we are commanded to hate. As the Talmud says, if you see your friend sinning, you should hate him, and you should tell your teacher to hate him. Now here we're saying that we have to love every Jew. Is there an exception? The Jew, your friend who sins, is not included in this mitzvah of loving your fellow Jew? So the Rebbe makes it very clear that the commandment, the instruction to hate a sinful Jew has two qualifications to it. Number one, it has to be your friend, which means two things. Number one, he knows as much as you know. So he's not lacking in information. He's not lacking in inspiration. That which inspired you, the study, the learning that inspired you to behave yourself, he studied as well, and he knows it too. And you have the same teacher, your colleagues, your peers, your classmates. And yet he continues to sin. You've also already tried to correct him by chastising him. And you've fulfilled that obligation. And it still hasn't helped, and he's still sinning. Then you have a commandment and a mitzvah to hate him, because you can't justify his misbehavior as unintentional or out of ignorance. The second qualification is that even the individual whom you are obligated to hate, you're still obligated to love him. No one removed that obligation. So it turns out that the person who is your friend, who is your peer, who is continuing to sin even though you've tried to stop him and you've chastised him and nothing helps, and you are therefore obligated, you have a mitzvah to hate him, you still have a mitzvah to love him as well. So this poor individual who the Torah singles out for hatred engages you, involves you more than the average person. The average person you have to love. This person you have to love and hate. It's a deep involvement. So the mitzvah to love your fellow Jew has no exceptions. There are no exceptions. There are those who, in addition to loving them, you have a mitzvah to hate them as well, in order to either bring them back or to not be influenced by their behavior. Which means that a person who you don't know, who is not your friend, the person who is not your peer, the person who has not studied under the same teacher as you, even if they're sinful, you have no right to hate them at all, you attribute their misbehavior to unintentional sins. They simply don't know. They're not inspired. And even if you tell them you're not allowed to do this, they don't understand what not allowed means. They don't understand what sin means. They don't understand what God means. And therefore their sins are unintentional, and you have no reason to hate them at all. You have only the mitzvah to love them. And through the love, as the Rebbe describes it, through heavy ropes of love, you draw them closer to the commandments, you draw them closer to the service of God, you draw them closer to Torah. And if these heavy cords of love don't produce, they don't bring him any closer to Torah, and the person doesn't start to do more mitzvahs, which is rare and unusual. But even if that were to happen, even if it didn't work, and the person didn't become any holier or any more observant of the commandments, your love has not been wasted. You have fulfilled the mitzvah of loving your fellow Jew. So the love is unconditional. What the Rebbe is saying is that in contrast to the person who is sinning, whom you are obligated to chastise and to bring back to observance, because he knows better, he has studied, he has learned, he has been given all the opportunities, and then you have an obligation to stop him from sinning. And in fact, that's the only reason that God allows us to see another person's sins. God wants us to be good. Wants everybody to be good. What virtue is there in the fact that one human being can see another person's evil or another person's wickedness? What's the virtue there? If God allows us to see another person's wickedness, it must mean that we are responsible in some way to fix that wickedness. And so we see the obligation, not the insult, to the individual. So if we see someone who really should stop sinning because there are peers, there are classmates, then we have an obligation to hate him and stop him from sinning. But if the person is not our peer and not our classmate, we shouldn't see their evil at all. We have no business noticing their evil. We should see only an opportunity to love a fellow Jew. And the fact that there's a sin there, that could be a reflection of our own wickedness, that we're really seeing ourselves, not the other person.